Welcome back to a very special episode of the New Yorker political scene. We have made it. There are just hours at this point left before Election Day. Hell, some of you might even be listening to this on Election Day, which is fine. There are no spoilers here, so no need to worry about that. I have tried on this show to bring you some analysis of both the news and of American politics, and also to have some guests on from time to time. This week, I am joined by the illustrious Tom Lewis. Tom's been covering our presidential election both for the BBC's Welsh Language Service as well as for the outlet Monocle. Beyond being both a great journalist and a fan of America, Tom is also my second favorite Welshman named Tom, after Tom Jones, of course. So please enjoy this discussion, which I think will make for a great companion piece to all of the political coverage you may or may not be watching. Either way, I think you'll enjoy this. So without further ado, here's my conversation with the one and only Tom Lewis.
I gotta tell you a story. Have a man all I know.
Tom, thank you so much for joining me on this very special election edition episode of the New Yorker political scene.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Russ. I feel very honored. I feel as like I'm joining an illustrious group of our former classmates and friends at Columbia. I'd like to think to myself that you're saving the best to last, but I'm also fully aware that Will Sloan and Dalal Mawad are figures I can only aspire to be. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, I am saving the best for last, but they haven't agreed yet to come on, so... In the interim, we got Mr. Tom Lewis.
Story of my life. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being on. As you may or may not know, usually what I do here is I make fun of the hosts of the New Yorker podcast, The Political Scene, which is probably, well, I find it to be quite fun, but probably not the smartest career move for me and maybe not for you. But... I wanted to start by asking you about what you've been up to here in America, and maybe if you could zoom out a little bit and talk about your relationship with America leading up to this election.
Well, yeah, I guess we'll start. You know, you're a very big part of my relationship with America, Russ, as are our mutual friends. We met at Columbia University School of Journalism many, many years ago. We're all getting kind of old now, Russ, aren't we? But yeah, that's where I guess my sort of story with America sort of begins, more than a decade ago now. And yeah, I moved to Washington, D.C. You actually drove me there, Russ.
That's after the Queen's Jubilee.
After the Queen's Jubilee, we'd graduated university. I'd got an internship at the BBC's Washington Bureau, and you very kindly drove me there on the next part of my adventure. And yeah, I was there for a year and then moved to London to work for Monocle, which is a sort of international affairs kind of magazine and radio station, lots of other things at this stage, who I still am a correspondent for. And yeah, I have been back and forth to America. I think this is my fourth election. I was trying to calculate this from 2012 was my first one when Barack Obama was re-elected. And I've sort of dipped in and out for various places kind of for all those elections since. And I think what's been kind of interesting. So yeah, I've been in Wisconsin, I guess, for the past week and a half or 2 weeks or something. I've never been to Wisconsin before, but seeing as it's one of the seven swing states, it felt like a good place to kind of base myself in the run-up to Election Day. But it's been interesting this time around. I think, you know, what I kind of really loved about our time at Columbia, and maybe kind of why I sort of wanted to be a journalist in the first place, was, you know, I feel we do get this kind of extraordinary license to speak to lots of different people, think about lots of different stories and things that we probably wouldn't have access to or license to speak about or explore kind of otherwise. So I think this kind of idea of maybe being an outsider to a story is something I've kind of always liked and kind of got a bit of a kick out as a journalist. And I'd say sort of maybe I'm sort of not an entirely an outsider to the US anymore, but I definitely feel a bit less of an outsider this time around. Given I just think the atmosphere is a bit different this time around. You know, there's definitely a bit more of a sort of wariness, I'd say, about people sort of, as soon as you say you're a journalist, kind of some people kind of have these assumptions about, you know, who you are and what your motives might be. And I think that's definitely felt very sort of different this time around, whereas usually I feel like most Americans are pretty friendly, open-armed kind of sort of people. And I don't want to sort of overblow that. You know, people have been supremely nice here and more than happy to volunteer how they feel. And, you know, I think it's worth saying, I think living in a swing state, any election cycle is pretty exhausting and pretty grueling. You only have to turn the TV on for, like, you know, 5 minutes or something, and it's back-to-back ads, all kind of pretty relentlessly sort of pushing their message to you. So people have been very friendly and very charming and very sort of open to sort of talk about things, sort of despite all that sort of pressure that they go under.
And what is the what are like the storylines that you and your the people you report for find interesting, or what are the sorts of narratives that you're sort of following now?
Well, I think that's it's a really interesting question, because that's also what people sort of ask, like, you know, kind of whose side are you on, or kind of what stories are you telling? What are you going to be sort of pushing, you know, in terms of the things you write or the radio pieces you put together? So I'm still working predominantly. I'm a correspondent in Canada, usually for Monocle magazine, but I'm also doing quite a lot of commentary for the BBC's Welsh language news services. I'm from Wales originally, so I should have said that at the start. Welsh is my first language, and it's the BBC in Wales where I sort of got my start in journalism before coming to New York and to Columbia. So I'd say in terms of the narratives...
Could you just give us a little sample? Just give us a little sample of Welsh. For the folks at home.
What would you like me to say?
Maybe just...
Okay, something election-y.
Yeah, sure.
Pan in i'n pleidleisio in i'n ennill, when we vote, we win. but I could also say, just for the sake of balance and fairness here, gwnewch American great unwaith eto, make America great again.
Yeah.
These are sort of all of the fly, but there you go. So whichever side of the fence your listeners are there, Russ, they'll have the Welsh to sort of see them through in their various political
I'll get that. I'll speed that to the campaigns right now.
you really should, yeah. Get those undecided Welsh-speaking voters motivated and off their chairs. But yeah, in terms of sort of the narratives and the stories, I think maybe going back to this idea of sort of being a bit of an outsider to a story, which I think there's still, obviously over the last few years, there's been a huge sort of conversation, lots of moves, you know, reviewing about who gets to tell stories or kind of how editorial decisions are made at sort of newsrooms. And those, of course, have been largely positive. But I think, you know, there's a place for lots of different types of journalism. And I think, you know, at least trying to be objective in a story, which again has lots of conversations about it at the moment, is still something valuable to sort of strive for. So I'd say, you know, what I kind of like about speaking to people is you know, simple questions, obviously, but what's motivating you to vote this year? Oh, the economy or something. But then it's kind of why the economy is an issue for them is always kind of interesting to me, I think, and actually is probably of more value to having these snapshots, these pieces of colour from people's lives that I think actually put a bit more flesh on the bones of a story than maybe falling into the big grand narratives that quite often take shape of an election, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I noticed... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like... I think, you know, I felt that since the 2016 election and the 2020 election, the U.S. media during those elections, well, 2016 was such a exceptional race because there'd never been a candidate in any living memory, but probably ever, like Donald Trump. And so that phenomenon really sort of shook up the way that the media here was used to covering an election. And then 2020 was such a sort of bizarre and dystopian moment because of COVID and also because of the Trump presidency, and 4 years of the Trump presidency also sort of scrambled the brains, I think, of a lot of people that cover elections in the media. So I felt like the coverage of that election was also very sort of heightened, and there was a sense that this was a distinct moment from what had come before. But I'm sort of getting the sense that now in this election, the media ecosystem in the United States has sort of become accustomed to Donald Trump, and it's hard to be at like a fever pitch for more than, you know, 4 years is a long time to be like at a 11 out of 10. So I feel like this election, the tenor of it almost feels more normal, or what had been sort of bizarre and alarming to people in the media has now become sort of the norm. So I'm curious what you think about that, and what, like, the outlets you work for or the audiences that you work for, like, are they still asking, like, what is wrong with America?
Yeah, I'm interested, Russ, in sort of what you think about that, because obviously we're sort of, you know, get told that 2016, in terms of the media, in terms of how the press covers something that has no precedent, or like something that has a tone that hasn't really been around to sort of, you know, work with before, if I can put it that way. You know, the lessons that were learned from 2016 in inverted commas. I wonder, do you think that there were lessons that were learned this time around? Obviously, you work in the media still, but just in your consumption of the media, you know, has the press in the US got any better in dealing with someone like Donald Trump, who, you know, hasn't really changed at all since 2016, you could argue, I would say, in terms of the way, the things that he says, the way that he conducts himself, the way that he says those things. Do you think we're still in some of the same issues in terms of the press in reporting those things, holding them to account if you want, or is the same pattern sort of still there, if that makes sense, in terms of how the media has reported some of these bits of the cycle and some other ones too?
Yeah, I think one of the problems with, like, the way the media has reflected on itself since 2016 is that it's too myopic in its, like, self-critique. So there's all this concern and focus about, like, the way they cover Donald Trump and whether or not they call him a liar. Or, for example, like, most recently, whether or not the Washington Post holds back its endorsement of Kamala Harris or publishes it, as if those instances on their own somehow are going to move the needle about the public's understanding of Donald Trump. I think that the media is in a downward spiral, and part of that is like a business problem that is very complex but involves like hyper-financialization. But I think editorially the problem has been that there isn't, the media has not done anything to build good faith when it comes to people who are conservative, people who live in rural America, you know, this demographic of people that's likely to support someone like Donald Trump. The media, if you look at public polling about this, you know, like, the media has lost all credibility with these people. These people have less faith in the media than they do in the government. You know, the media has like less favorable public perception than like the Internal Revenue Service. So there's a problem that's much more profound that involves not pursuing stories or reporting news that those people care about, and those people feeling constantly like they're either ignored or antagonized by the media's coverage. It could be, like, for example, your interest in economic issues, you know? It could be something as simple as that. Like, you don't see, or they don't feel, that the media is, like, covering issues that they care about, even those that transcend or are outside of, like, electoral politics. So then, when it comes time to cover the presidential election, there's, you know, what, how they decide to cover Trump in an election year is sort of too little too late, because they've already, you know, dug themselves a hole of credibility. They say, what is his name? Nero, like, played the fiddle when Rome burned during the fall of Rome. Okay, maybe in this case we don't have, like, a Nero playing the fiddle, but we certainly have, like, a Rome that's burning. You know, there's really, I find, systematic and dire problems that need to be addressed domestically, not to mention like the implications of the United States' policies for the rest of the world. And we can't even have like a a thoughtful or educated conversation about any of those things, seemingly.
Is that because things... it feels that, just from my experience here, let's say over the past sort of week and a half, 2 weeks, you know, it can feel that things are pretty binary in the US. You know, it's either, you know, the economy's bad, it's Kamala's fault, the economy's bad, Trump will fix it. You know, it's very, like you say, the nuance does feel kind of absent. But I will say as well, I think being here and, you know, speaking to people, having very nice conversations, looking people in the eye, you know, chatting away, not having a kind of, you know, any point to sort of prove on my part anyway. Just an anecdotal thing, Russ, you know, I went to a dive bar here in Milwaukee just for a quick drink, and there was a very sweet husband and wife. They lived in rural Wisconsin. They'd come to town to see a concert. The concert had been cancelled, so they went for dinner and then came to this little bar to do scratch cards that they'd bought. I think it was a birthday, and then to have some drinks. And they asked me what I did, and as soon as I said I was a journalist, the husband just closed up instantly, turned his back on me. And before I sort of knew it, they just sort of slipped out without sort of saying goodbye. So, I mean, you know, what does that say? Who knows? But I think it does show that there is quite a deep feeling of, well, we can't trust these kind of people. And I think that's what feels different this time, is that when, you know, your whole sort of reason for wanting to be a journalist is to have conversations with people, to learn about people's lives, maybe to sort of share a bit of yours with them, that it is kind of harder to do that now. And I would say, especially when you're covering Trump voters, like I did go to Donald Trump's Long Island rally, so before the Madison Square Garden rally a few days ago. But, you know, when you speak to people, and people were very open and happy to speak, but the sort of answers they gave about why Donald Trump was still their candidate, why they still sort of wanted him, you know, we're all kind of familiar with these things. You know, Joe Biden stole the election. He's a great businessman. He'll fix the economy. And I just feel, you know, it's much harder to sort of just pose sort of neutral questions there without becoming a full kind of adversary. You know, I'm not sort of in journalism to have fights with everyone or tell people that they're wrong. That couldn't be further from why I wanted to sort of be in this world or do this job. But it does make it a little bit more tricky when you're constantly being pushed back at, and what your sort of role is there. Maybe I'm making this more complicated for myself than I need to be, but I don't think it is really my role to sort of tell sort of everyone that they're wrong. But I think it was also a role to tell people when, you know, something they believe is, you know, proven to be untrue.
Yeah. I just think, going back to what I was saying about this, like, credibility problem of journalism, one thing I found really interesting about the Trump and now the Trump-Vance ticket is they've leaned into what has been, like, a personal obsession of mine, which is the media's complicity and involvement in selling the Iraq war to the American people. And probably to the British people. You know,
but that's still being studied. That is still being studied. You know, loads of soul searching in the UK, for example, about that. And, you know, when you have the benefit of time to look back, you do think, well, that was wild that, you know, newspapers felt that they had to endorse, or one way or the other, they had to become part of this kind of national story in the UK. But then, you know, does that then sort of overlap onto what you are sort of saying now? I'm not you know, endorsing one way or the other, but I think that is being examined.
Yeah, and I mean, my point is
like, wow, that was a wild time.
Here's the thing. It's possible that it might be examined, you know, but like Thomas Friedman, who's one of the biggest proponents of the Iraq War at the time, who said some like really like crazy, bellicose, violent, and frankly racist things in his columns and on television, is still a New York Times columnist, was an advisor to the Biden administration, and is on CNN regularly spewing the same sort of ideas, you know? So maybe there's like a self-reflection among people like you and people like me about mistakes that were made, but there's seemingly no consequence for those mistakes. And those mistakes, like whether or not the entire media class like encouraged and cheerleaded an illegal invasion of Iraq that ended up killing more or less 2 million people throughout the region, completely destabilizing an entire like part of the world. The people who were at the helm of those organizations and who made those editorial decisions are still there. And I'm not saying the same types of people are there. I'm saying literally the same individuals are there. And in fact, the New Yorker political scene, the podcast that I make fun of on my podcast, they did a retrospective on the 20th anniversary of the invasion last year. And they went around, they had, I don't know, David Remnick was there and a few other guests who aren't regulars on this podcast. And they went around and basically every single one of them said, like, yeah, we thought that the Iraqis were going to receive us as liberators, and we thought the war would be over in 2 weeks, and we thought, you know, we were shocked when we went in with the troops and we saw that people were furious and they were coming out and throwing rocks at the tanks, and this caught us all by surprise. Now, those people that were so shocked at what happened after the U.S. invaded Iraq, they've all been promoted. They're all now in like higher editorial positions than they were 20 years ago.
I think it's interesting because I think it speaks to one thing that I think is kind of unique about U.S. journalism that doesn't really have a counterpart. Well, didn't at that time. It doesn't really have a counterpart, definitely not in Canada where I live, certainly not in the UK either, is this, you know, you can have very prominent, say, figures in a presidential administration, and then you go in and you sort of become a sort of full journalist, a commentator, a columnist, you know, on something. I remember when I was sort of growing up in sort of UK Welsh news, that, you know, as soon as you sort of revealed your political leanings, to say if you ran for office or got a job as a spokesman in a government or something, you kind of knew that you probably wouldn't be able to be a journalist again in the same kind of way. Whereas that isn't the case in the US, where actually, you know, having had this experience does seem in some cases to qualify you to then be this kind of neutral thing.
Right. George Stephanopoulos goes from the 1992 Bill Clinton campaign to the anchor chair at one of the country's biggest
news networks. And David Frum, am I right in thinking, for who writes for The Atlantic?
David Frum, yes. He had been a speechwriter for George W. Bush. Jen Psaki has a show on MSNBC.
I mean, I guess Jen Psaki is maybe slightly different because MSNBC is kind of an overtly political thing, isn't it? So that kind of makes a bit more sense. But I would say
the audience we're talking about, who's sort of lost faith or finds that the media is not credible, they're not saying, well, Jen Psaki, who apparently signed a contract with MSNBC while still kept her job in the Biden press department for months after she'd already signed this contract with MSNBC. They're not in their minds thinking like, well, that's cable news and that's sort of opinion, and so that's different. In their minds, they're just like, what the fuck is this? The lady literally went from the Biden podium straight to the anchor chair.
But do you think people are thinking that? Do you think people think as granularly about the news and things that we
do? I don't know how granularly they think about it. But what I do know is there is, and I know because I've been a part of it, you know, there is like a cynical manipulation that goes into covering stories, writing about stories, picking which stories to cover. You know, there is like editorial problems that are really pretty like glaring. I don't know, like I worked at CNN when they let one of their top anchors interview his brother, who was the governor of New York during the pandemic when 20,000 people had just died in a nursing home. And they just made jokes about their mother's meatball recipe. I worked with Chris Cuomo. I like him as a person. But that was like any like high school journalism school class would teach you that's wrong. So whether the audience is explicitly pointing their finger and saying this person went from this job to that job, I think the fact is, they can watch the coverage or read the news or listen to the radio and feel that there's something disingenuous about it, which there is. That's my take.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for example, the Cuomo brothers interview, I can't see a world ever where an equivalent interview would have been sort of okayed in, say, the Canadian market. I mean, they're very different worlds. The idea of sort of, you know, these kind of dynasties of politics and media don't really sort of match as well, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong, but they don't match as well, say, to the UK or to Canada. But I think if you were going to do that, you would have flagged it as this unique thing. We know this is kind of out of the ordinary. We know this is unusual, but look how wild this is. And we just thought it'd be interesting and fun, instead of sort of guising it as sort of a serious kind of news interview, which, as you say, I think, you know, obviously came with a whole host of sort of editorial problems, you know, in terms of kind of what you're actually trying to sort of do there. And again, I feel like when you talk about the media, because of the time we're in, every, you know, lots of this language has become loaded. So it's sort of, you know, it automatically starts sounding conspiratorial, like there's some big, you know, Machiavelli kind of force at play behind the scenes, you know, just while you're trying to talk about something, just the nuts and bolts of how journalism works. But would you say, from your experience, that when those editorial discussions happen, and again, maybe I'm asking, putting a lot on your plate here, to, you know, account for the entire US media, but do you feel that those individual discussions, the way those stories get sort of mixed together in the pot, where the way, you know, stories are evaluated, are those coming from an attempt to be objective, objectively what is important, objectively why is this story of value? Or do you think that there are kind of perhaps unspoken sort of biases that do come into play? And I guess, you know, what are those biases? Is it from, well, I think there was a famous phrase, is it Jim Lehrer, who used to present PBS NewsHour, you know, will they care about this in Kansas City or whatever? You know, is it that kind of thing? Or is there something else, maybe just a set of assumptions that, you know, people who tend to sort of rise up to be in newsrooms and making these decisions, biases that they just sort of bring with them, I guess, you know, perhaps not even without sort of knowing it explicitly. You know, what was your sort of experience of that?
I mean, obviously I worked in, I still work in news television, so it's maybe I have less authority to speak about like newspapers or magazines, but I do consume a lot of newspapers, magazines, and public radio, and I think that there's a lot of crossover and overlap these days, so it's sort of, you know, like when you work at CNN, you're constantly interfacing with reporters from the New York Times and reporters from the Washington Post, who are also contributors at CNN. In fact, I used to work with two of the hosts of the political scene who are also CNN contributors. It was part of the reason why I wanted to do this podcast that I'm doing. So I think there's a combination of factors. One is there are cynical people who are motivated by furthering some political agenda, and there's a lot of those people, especially on television, who are like, you know, they serve on the board of a weapons company that does contracting with the Defense Department, and then they're also doing punditry about Ukraine and in Israel. And then there's people like Thomas Friedman. You know, it's very common. You're trying to figure out what to do for a panel discussion about foreign policy, and the executive producer will just forward you Thomas Friedman's column and say, like, this probably is a good jumping off point for a discussion about Israel, you know? And I think that there's also the fact that a lot of television news executives and people who are making editorial decisions are not journalists, they're TV people. I appreciate that a lot more now that I've worked in television for the last 10 years. And I think I had gone into it with the assumption that these were people that thought deeply about ethics and thought deeply about editorial decision making the way you're describing it. But actually, these are people who maybe they came from sports. Maybe they ran a show for ESPN. Maybe they ran a show for Fox News. Maybe they ran a show like The Apprentice, like Jeff Zucker did, you know, who used to be the head of CNN. He had come from programming at NBC, doing these big, like, splashy reality shows. So these people are making decisions with a completely different framework, and they're being manipulated by the cynical actors who have this political agenda, you know, and sometimes being taken along for the ride or sometimes going along for the ride happily. But there really is no, as I understand it, there's very little appetite for deep critical thought about these things, in part because they've taken on like so much investment from these like huge venture capital sources that are trying to get like exponential growth on investments. So that just that rewards people who think like Jeff Zucker. That rewards people who are really mostly focused on like, how do we get the largest number of eyeballs at any given point in time to watch this thing? We're going to make decisions based mostly on that. And if we can do it in a thoughtful way so that it's not just like pornography and cat videos, then I guess like we'll get, you know, we get a bonus for that. But
well, a lot of people that I've spoken to here, when they talk about the news, they've talked about the idea of breaking news, how actually if you watch a rolling American news channel, everything is kind of breaking news at the moment. So talking about sort of living life at 11. But again, I feel like when you have, you know, news services like the BBC or the CBC in Canada, the CBC, I think, is part commercials and publicly funded, whereas the BBC, there are no sort of commercials unless you're watching overseas, which they do fund by sort of advertising. But there isn't the same drive. So I think that does change the dynamic in terms of whether you need to keep the sort of money rolling in, or, you know, whether the journalistic principles are just based on, well, this is a really important story.
Let me get your thoughts, if you like, on some of these clips before we run out of time here. What do you think?
Perfect. Okay, this is fun.
Okay,
jukebox.
I think some of these will actually tie in nicely to this discussion we've been having about the media and about the media's role in the election, or what the media's place should be in an election. These are some clips from recent episodes of the New Yorker political scene in the run-up to the election. I think this first one is Evan Osnos.
So there is a way in which truth has become a four-letter word for Trump's people. And that's a very hard thing to come back from, I have to say, without being too bleak about it. That's a very hard – it's harder to rebuild the culture around, you know, in even a faith in the very idea of verifiable facts. That's something we've been sort of imagining and contending with since he got on the scene, but it is now a fully enshrined piece of the reality in this country.
So you and I have been talking offline about what's happening in Pennsylvania and the Trump campaign's efforts to try to plant the seeds for some sort of, you know, challenging of the results should Trump lose there. And I do think that this is like, it's part of the reason why I'm like not so interested in who's going to win on Tuesday. I mean, it is interesting and it's sort of fun to think about. But to me, what's even more interesting to think about is there's three scenarios. Harris wins and Trump challenges the results. Trump wins and God knows what will happen then, or what Harris will do then. And the third possibility is it's really close and it can't be called for a while. And in any of those scenarios, it just seems like there's mayhem ahead.
Well, I think number two, if Trump wins outright, Kamala Harris will concede, as is the way, you know, you would hope that this political system works.
The liberals are going to light their hair on fire. There's already liberals. I don't know if you've run into these people out in the heartland that are convinced that there was like a conspiracy to get Joe Biden to drop out. Like there's people that, there's a blue anon.
Introduced me to that. And I hadn't heard of blue anon before. I'm not familiar.
I like to think I coined it. I might've stolen it, but
you should get to the little trademark office quick. Cause I'm sure you could make a dime or two off that, especially if the result is a contested one. Look, I don't know if you've heard of the Marquette University Law School poll, opinion poll here in Milwaukee. I think it's been ranked as the third most respected, best opinion poll in the country. And they're kind of a small operation, so they're, you know, very proud of you know, the quality of their poll. Anyway, so I went on Wednesday to the unveiling of the final poll before Election Day for here in Wisconsin. And they had, for the presidential ticket, they had Harris up one, so Harris 51, Trump 49. But the margin error was 4.4, I think. So the pollster, who I think is kind of a sort of politics celebrity in Wisconsin, he's pretty well known, kind of quite a sort of, you know, father of the data kind of figure here, really lovely, knows absolutely everything at his sort of fingertips. And what he was trying to say was that absolutely whatever result happens after Election Day on Tuesday, no one should be surprised, because anything is possible at this stage. Now, obviously, he was also asked about this idea of, say, some Republicans and pollsters trying to sort of flood the polling. I forget what the actual phrase of that is, but sort of grouping polling to sort of sway things, push things a bit more sort of Republican. Again, he was very measured when he answered that. He was like, you know, there is some evidence that some of that has been happening. But he also said that obviously in a political mood where people's minds changed, you know, you would therefore expect lots of opinion polls to be tracking that change in mood. I mean, it seems kind of like, you know, obvious. So he said, you know, there has been evidence of some of that happening, but also it's not that surprising given that sort of, you know, political electoral appetites are changing, and it would be strange if kind of various polling companies weren't sort of reflecting that, if that makes sense. And it was kind of interesting, you know, I've never been to an event where they actually unveil an opinion poll and you see kind of what they asked, how it broke down, who the people were. And it's just, it is really sort of interesting to see that, because it counters, or it cuts through, I should say, more kind of a lot of the assumptions you as a journalist sort of make speaking to people, you know, for example, speaking to people who are still undecided as of a few days ago. They think Trump is an excellent businessman, but they don't like his personality. They really like Kamala Harris, but they don't know, you know, what she will do. She feels still like a bit of an unknown. I met her. She drives an Uber to supplement her income, which is, she's an accountant for an agricultural company. So she said she earned about $70,000 a year doing that job, about $40,000 a year driving Ubers. And life was just really, really expensive for her. And the person she thought would fix that was Donald Trump. And what was interesting about this poll was, is that they obviously ask sort of, you know, neutral questions and political questions. So the question of what is the biggest issue for you in Wisconsin, I think it was 38% said the economy, the state of the economy, that their family's finances, they felt, had got worse over the past 4 years. And that was the top sort of group. And then when you overlap that with like another separate question they'd asked, who do you think will do best with the economy? That is Donald Trump. So it's kind of interesting seeing for yourself then how these things kind of overlap. And then if, for example, President Trump did win by a small margin in Wisconsin, the presidency, you know, those, the way they put those components out there sort of, you know, for you to put the jigsaw together yourself, it was all kind of there for you to see.
Yeah, that's all, I think, very interesting, like nuance into what an election result will mean, right? Like in terms of the narrative of the country and the narrative of like whatever the result is on Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, whenever we get it. At the New Yorker Political Scene podcast, there seems to be a really simplified understanding of what a result in this election will mean, like what it will say about America and how history will remember it. And what it boils down to for these hosts basically is like, does American democracy work and is it healthy? And if the answer is yes, then that means Harris will win. Or is there something like rotten that's over, like a cancer that's overwhelmed America's political system? That is what Donald Trump winning will have meant, if that's the result. So I'm going to play this clip. I will say this. I've been listening to this podcast for years. you very rarely hear a disagreement between the hosts. And in this instance, there is a disagreement. Evan Osnos is sort of saying he thinks American democracy and journalism, whatever, the political system that we have is functioning because people that told lies about Donald Trump in 2020, like Rudy Giuliani, have paid a price. And there is like a system of checks and balances when you're going around, for example, spreading lies about the election. There's a consequence to be paid. Susan Glasser, on the other hand, thinks that it's broken. So have a listen.
I think what we've seen is the inadequacy of our system. I mean, to me, the story of the Biden era writ large is the failure to hold to account a political party and a leader of that party who has gone rogue in our society, who has chosen to flaunt the foundations of our constitutional system. And we have shown that we are not able to impose accountability on that, that our constitution didn't work.
Just to come in between the two of you, I think that the verdict is not in yet. We don't know how the election comes out yet. It is entirely possible that Donald Trump will be facing a trial in Washington if Harris wins this election, and we don't know the outcome yet. But
Jane, but wait a minute. I got to ask you, do you really believe that our system has shown that it can protect itself against these lies?
Well, I think that's a false standard. I don't think that's exactly what we're talking about. What we're saying is, are there avenues by which you can have a demonstration effect in public to show that there is a consequence for lying? And if that's not saying that that solves everything. But if you say, well, that doesn't matter.
I didn't say it didn't matter. I think we are
desperately in need of reforms on social media that will impose consequences for the lies.
Anyway, I just love Jane Mayer. It's like this huge crisis for American democracy and political life. And she's like, I think what needs to happen is there needs to be like regulation of social media. Anyway, for them, what's at stake here is our political system works. Everything's fine. Harris wins. Trump wins. Like you're talking about a few tens of thousands of people voting one way or the other. That is the hinge point for this greater narrative. What do you think about what that says about the way they think about politics? And what do you think about the idea that that is what's at stake in this election?
I think in the Clipress, they were talking about sort of holding to account, showing the sort of system, showing people that the system kind of works. Can I give you a little sort of anecdote again from, I know it's the laziest journalism to tell people what your taxi driver's told you, but
yeah, speaking of Tom Friedman here, yes. Tom Friedman, foreign correspondent, classic.
But
wait, can I just interrupt you for 1 second to tell you what I'm doing right now?
Are you going to the toilet?
No, I'm gonna start to walk towards my car to drive to my bagel meeting.
Oh yeah, of course.
Jake. Shout out to Jake. Yes. Shout out to Jake.
Can I just record this answer?
But we're going to keep recording.
Okay,
we can keep going.
Okay, great.
I'm just taking this operation on the road, which is kind of fun. I've never done this before.
Look at this. This is like an outside broadcast. You're like
for listeners who don't know, I'm walking through my apartment lobby to my car to drive to.
I should also get going, so do need to check out soon as well. Well, okay, I'm just going to say this answer, Russ, really quick, and you'll have it on my recording. Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. As long as you want to keep going, let's keep going.
Okay, I do have to go soon. So, okay, starting again. So the clip the clip was discussing kind of how sort of the excesses of one side are sort of held to account, kind of, you know, how you can show the people that the system works and things. So I know it's incredibly lazy journalism to report what your taxi driver's told you. But I did have a ride back from Waukesha County, which is on the sort of in the suburbs of Milwaukee and is much more Republican than Milwaukee itself. And he initiated a conversation about the election. I'm going to say he was probably in his mid-20s. He works as a server at a restaurant and also works as an Uber driver. And he was saying that the restaurant he works at is in a very Republican area, lots of pretty wealthy patrons who all own their own businesses and are all pretty much pretty vocally and explicitly supporting Donald Trump for president. And he said that they all are really, really keen every time they come in for dinner to press him as the server on what his political views are, on who he's supporting for president. And he said, so I've just sort of got a line now, and I say, well, I really love God, and I know Donald Trump loves God, so I'm voting for Donald Trump. The impact of that is that the diners will tip him the entire value of the meal as a tip. And he said that his sort of colleagues who get into more debates with the tables that they're serving, maybe sort of pushing back a little, they'll either get no tips or they'll get very small tips in response. Now, the driver was pretty quick to admit that he has no intention of voting for Donald Trump. He's Mexican American. His family is from Mexico originally. But he just felt that that was kind of the system that, you know, he'd found himself in as a server. And so, you know, if you want to look at things about sort of holding people to account, I don't know if this is a bit of a sort of cynical way to sort of turn this, but, you know, he's found his way in the game of politics this time around. And that's how he's chosen to play, by getting really healthy tips, by saying that he loves Donald Trump because of Donald Trump's love of God. So I just, you know, that's a little bit of colour from the ground for you there, as to show perhaps how, if people want to hold the Republican Party of Donald Trump to account, maybe that's one way of doing it. And I guess kind of, you know, telling myths truths or little white lies and things is actually a part of the campaign now as well, with this idea that Republican women can vote differently to their Trump-supporting husbands. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question for you, maybe to wrap it up here, is like, so you're going to go on, I'm assuming, like the Welsh language radio, the BBC, and maybe on Monocle, and you're going to, after the election results come out, and you're going to talk about the results and I guess what they mean, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, like, what will the results mean for history based on who wins? Do you think that that's like an appropriate way to look at something like a presidential election that's so close that all polls show it's within the margin of error? That, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
If Trump wins, it will have meant that American democracy is healthy and strong and America is A-OK and great. Or if Trump wins, it means something's gone terribly wrong, because ultimately, a few thousand people in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan had voted one way or the other.
Yeah, I don't think I'd feel sort of as bold as sort of, you know, making maybe assessments, especially say if we're talking like as the result is finally announced, you know, while the dust is still in the air. I think, you know, if there are data points, for example, so in the early voting that we've seen so far, the number of Republican women, I believe, is incredibly high in the early vote at the moment. Now, I get the sense that people are deducing that perhaps this campaign, this push to try and get Republican women to vote for Kamala Harris, you know, not for Donald Trump, perhaps the candidate that their husbands or their families are sort of voting for. I think that will be really interesting to see if there is any way of, you know, teasing out whether that has actually happened. And I think, you know, that will be something to be discussed and be very, you know, worth discussing. And I think, you know, what's the value of saying what this means or trying to characterize things? I think, there is kind of a value to that to a degree, but I think that you have to make those kind of, this might sound like an obvious thing to say, but I think you definitely have to anchor those things in something more than like an assumption or kind of the perceived wisdom of the time, if that makes sense. Just a final thing, yeah. I remember on election night in 2016, the day after the election, I was on Welsh language television. They had a big setup in New York, and the presenter, who's a very respected figure in the Welsh language media, she was saying that, you know, Hillary Clinton was such an unpopular figure, you know, why the Democrats had gone with her. And, you know, again, not just trying to be journalistic here during that, you know, when she, and again, maybe, you know, this has been sort of, you know, forgotten in the collective memory as well. But, you know, when she did declare her candidacy for a second time, she was, you know, you can go back and look, the most popular political name in the country. And, you know, she became very unpopular. I know this is probably another podcast worth of thing. But I think, you know, you don't have to be endorsing one side or the other to actually just note what was happening at the time. So there's no doubt that, she, for example, in this case, Hillary Clinton was very unpopular by Election Day came. When she announced that wasn't the case. So the story, I think, in my mind was interesting. It's like, well, what changed? And I think that's what gives you a more realistic view of just how unusual that sort of campaign was, maybe to sort of end where we started, Russ. But so I think, you know, making this sweeping assessments obviously always, I think, have to come with kind of a caveat. And I think those caveats, if you're a journalist, have to be based in your reporting, conversations you've had, even if they're not entirely scientific, like some of the, you know, stories or conversations or interactions I've had with you. You know, I'm fully aware I'm not a pollster. I'm not sort of surveying people in a big scientific way. It's just conversations that I've had. But I feel as though they've been instructive to me, Russ, in, you know, covering this election cycle from Milwaukee and Wisconsin this time around. But also, I think, you know, when you look at the bigger narrative, the way they're portrayed in the media, having those things to anchor your understanding, I think, are really, really helpful when you are trying to think of these bigger picture things. And like you say, trying to unpick what, in a bigger sense, things might mean, in inverted commas.
What you said just made me think of one final point I wanted to make and maybe get your thoughts on. I think my big takeaway from having sort of done this, like, sort of study of the New Yorker political scene, which I find interesting because these are some of the most respected sort of eggheads in Washington journalism. And so I find it to be an interesting prism through which to sort of look at how American media thinks about politics just in general. And I think one of my, like, thesis statements about American journalism and these three in particular is that they're sort of blind to some of their biases. And one of those biases that's, I think, very acceptable in American media that everyone sort of has is American exceptionalism. So they really do believe that, like, America is the greatest country on earth. We're destined to continue to be the greatest country on earth. And that's why, like, the Trump presidency is sort of looms so large in their psychology. Like, is this an aberration or is this where we're headed? And they're sort of obsessed with that because it doesn't jive with the exceptional, like, status that they believe ideologically that America has in the world. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what my thoughts are. I think...
Is America exceptional?
I think in a way that wouldn't be articulated in the same way. But I mean, I wonder in a way, do all sort of nations have some sort of that feeling in their media sort of ecosystem? So you're, you know, the stories you tell being the top of the running order for your country, but not, you know, not making the news at all, kind of in another. I guess kind of the American exceptional idea is something that's, like, expressed and is part of, I guess, kind of what you're told as Americans, you know, is part of your sort of identity. I don't know if I feel qualified to say, you know, if that then is kind of what kind of these grandee journalists are trying to sort of promote in any way. But I will say what I do like about working for, you know, for example, a magazine that, you know, kind of doesn't really have a center point in terms of the geographic spread. It's, you know, every country that you know, we have audiences in, you know, those stories are being covered in a way that, you know, if you're sitting in Tokyo or in Mexico City, you're going to be reading that same story about sort of either place. And I think there's something very refreshing about that, because it means that you have to sort of rely on, you know, the local, local or national expertise about why a story might be at the top of or the front page of a newspaper, for example, in Mexico, but we're going to publish it, for example, in Monocle, and, you know, readers in Australia or Germany or wherever are going to read that story, whereas you're probably maybe not going to read that story in one of the big, you know, maybe in on BBC News or, you know, in the New York Times or something. And, you know, we're a monthly magazine, obviously, so the metabolism is a little different to a big daily news organization. But what I think is refreshing, and maybe this comes down to back to the idea of, you know, at least striving to be objective if you possibly can be, which again, I think is important when we're, you know, for us journalists still, especially in a time where people perhaps don't trust the media as much, you know, where business models are in flux, where things are kind of being turned on their head in lots of different ways. You know, I think trying to sort of have a clear-eyed view about why a story is important, why a story is of interest, why it's of value, you know, that can be achieved in a way, I think, perhaps a little more freely, where you're catering, you know, to an audience where, you know, a lot of perhaps the traditions or maybe the baked in kind of assumptions about an audience don't sort of really exist, if that's a fair way of putting it. So
yeah,
so I don't know if that really answers your question, but I feel that probably any country you go to would have the kind of, maybe, you know, if you want to call them biases, let's call them biases for the sake of this, in the kind of stories they publish or in their kind of the way their national news sort of outlets, you know, portray and publish the news. I think that's why there's such fascination, though, with the United States around the world. And so many people here in Milwaukee have been like, what do people think? Are people nervous about this election? Well, I think
we're like animals in a zoo for you. You're here doing you're gawking at our freakish nature.
And having a great time doing so. I've had a great time here in Milwaukee. The good people of Wisconsin have been very kind.
I really do love how you love America.
I do. And I think, you know, it's, as I say, I think Russ, you know, when you're, I mean, I feel like this is maybe where some of our friendship was forged over the years, but you've obviously lived and worked and traveled kind of in lots of different countries around the world as well. And I think, you know, when I went to the United States, came to New York, it was, you know, I was quite wet behind the ears, but so excited and was pinching myself that I was kind of even there. But I think what makes that so special is that I, you know, made some of my best friends in recent times, you included, Russ, kind of during that time in the United States. And I think as soon as you make friends somewhere, you know, a lot of the bigger sweeping narratives or assumptions or characterizations about a place kind of fall away a little bit, because your association with that place is tied to a person or to people or to experiences you've had together. I hope this doesn't sound too sort of florid, but it is kind of, I think, why I do love America so much, is because a lot of the friendships I made there and the, you know, being an outsider, being not an outsider, you know, I think, you know, it's a place that I do really love still, even though, if, you know, it definitely feels a little bit different this time around. Maybe all political seasons feel different, but yeah, I do love America, Russ, and I would say that you and our shared friendships are definitely a big part of why I do.
Beautiful. Well, I'm glad you got that on the record. In case Trump wins the election, you won't be, you know, put up against the wall.
Yeah, just send me grapes to the prison cell where I'm.
I'll make sure of that.
Yeah, please. Send me just codes or something. I don't know, secret codes to the prison cells underground wherever I end up, Russ. Just know that I love you.
Beautiful.
If this is the last time we talk.
I love you too, Tom. I love you too. Thanks for being on my podcast.
Thank you for having me, Russ. It's been brilliant to talk to
you. Where should the good people find you in your work, Tom?
That's a good question. Well, they can find... can I just ask you, Russ, what is this bit? Do I give them like my aunt's Instagram handle?
Or whatever. Just say, you know, you can find my reporting on monocle.com. Whatever you want.
Okay, great. Well, for the, I'm sure, well, hopefully that this appearance, Russ, will boost the number of Welsh speakers who listen to your podcast. So I will say that.
That would be great.
You can hear me probably pretty regularly over the next kind of week or two on BBC Radio Cymru, which is the Welsh language news service on radio and on TV as well, I think, in the coming days. And then, of course, Monocle Magazine, monocle.com. You can hear me on the radio and read my things there as well.
Beautiful, Tom. I look forward to seeing your punim announcing whatever the results are and telling the world what it means about America.
I would try my best, Russ. I would try my best.
There you have it, folks. The one and only Tom Lewis.
The old hometown looks the same.
Now, there's one last clip I was hoping to play for Tom, but we ran out of time. This is historian Michael Beschloss speaking to the hosts of The Political Scene at this year's New Yorker Festival. It's a final piece of great American delusion as we wait for the results of this election.
If you look at the whole of American history, you have to say with a little luck, the land is bright.
Folks, on that note, I'm afraid that is all the time we have for.
Keep dreaming, America.
Yes, they'll all come to meet me, arms reaching, smiling sweetly. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. The old house is still standing, though the paint is cracked and dry. And there's that old oak tree that I used to play on. Down the lane I walk with my sweet Mary, hair of gold and lips like cherries. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. And look around me at four gray walls that surround me, and I realize, yes, I was only dreaming. For there's a God and there's a sad old portrait. On and on we'll walk at daybreak again. I'll touch the green, green grass.